it's nice to be able to go in the afternoon after you've heard almost everything I'm going to say. So I'm going to skip through some slides and maybe just make some other points, because there's another aspect to the study of animal minds. So just jumping right in, general questions that motivate my research, and of course that of others, is what do animals feel about what's happening to them? What is it like to be a dog or another animal? What does it feel like to be that animal? What is their point of view? Not do they have a point of view. They have a point of view. I accept a lot that some people might not accept. Why do we continue to slaughter and silence, especially sentient animals? Why do we do invasive things in the name of science, food, clothing, or entertainment? I know you can read all this. So this is basically what I'm going to talk about. And I'm not a primatologist. I think so many of the debates just get, I don't know, even know what the word is, but, you know, people studying primates studying primates, you know, and they get all involved in all the personal issues and all the things that are really pretty unimportant. So as a non-primatologist, I can say anything I want because I don't study primates. And I can actually, you know, maybe even get funding for doing non-primate work. I think this is going to work. Oh. Okay. I will do it mechanically. Okay. Boom. Great. So just last week, excuse me, Dale Jamieson and I were at a meeting at UCLA on the question of how like us are they? And I'm just showing you a few quotes. And you can read these. I'm not going to read them all the way through. But, you know, they're like us. They, meaning other animals, are like us in many ways and unlike us in many ways. And actually, the same is true. We're like them in many ways and unlike them in many ways. They have preferences and want to avoid pain and suffering. They have desires and beliefs. We're very confused about our relationship with animals. You know, when people tell me they love animals and harm them, I always say I'm glad they don't love me. Because we have a very complex relationship with animals. I like to ask people who do invasive research, would you do it to your dog? Would you put your dog in a laboratory where certain sorts of research is done? Would you put your dog on a factory farm? It just gets the discussion going. We need to do something with the information we have. We need to share it with non-researchers, because what animals feel and know matters to them as it should to us. I'm just going to offer a Cliff Notes summary of a more comparative perspective on animal behavior. So the questions that motivated the meeting in California, can you hear me? Yeah, okay. You know, what did the scientific data say? I'm giving you a summary now because it's going to be a different talk than you've heard, some of the talks you've heard. So there are both similarities and differences, and we know enough not to warrant not using sentient beings in invasive research. What are the best theories of evolutionary biology, cognitive ethology, and behavioral psychology tell us about the minds of primates? They're complex, they're sophisticated, they've evolved, different capacities have evolved in many different species, they have rich and deep emotional lives, and that we need to pay attention to individual variation within species. There's rampant variation within species, so we shouldn't be talking about the dolphin, the chimpanzee, the coyote, the wolf, the animals who I know the best. What aspects of minds are accessible to scientific study and what are limitations? There are extreme limitations, and you heard Dale Jamieson's question talk this morning. There's also extreme limitations on the conclusions that we can draw from captive animals. Okay, sometimes it's the same four animals who have been used in repeated research by different researchers in different conditions, in different, say, states of health, for example. So when people get all hung up about the failure to replicate from one lab to another, I mean, I think that's a problem, but I think we really need to look at the details of why certain research is not replicable. Do animals understand the intentions of conspecifics? I think they do. Do they show what one may consider altruistic and empathic behavior? I'm not sure about altruism. We could talk about that later. I think they do show empathy. And then these are just my answers. Do they have a theory of mind? Yes, I believe they do. Can they plan for the future? Yeah, I think they can. Do they understand mortality? I don't know if they understand mortality per se, but you definitely see these grieving ceremonies that occur in different species. This may not work. Did it shift?
Did you pull the little thing out there and put it in here?
I did. Doesn't work. So speciesism, where you are characterizing animals as members of the species and ignoring individual differences. Can you read this slide back there? Well, I'll risk being whatever. It says, listen up, Maynard, you may be a higher species with a more well-developed brain, but I'll tell you one thing, you'll never catch me sniffing assholes to see who my friends are. The problem with the speciesism point of view is that it leads to these incorrect conclusions about who animals are. Higher animals are better, they're more valuable, they're smarter. Lower animals are lesser, if you will, less valuable, and dumber. Okay, and these are just really misleading characteristics or typologies. And I have Groucho Marx thing too here, in terms of the generalizations that we make in speciesistic types of conclusions. And this says, Groucho Marx in Duck Soup, Firefly saying to Trentino, maybe you can suggest something. As a matter of fact, you do suggest something. To me, you suggest a baboon. And Trentino goes, what? And Groucho Marx says, I'm sorry, that isn't fair to the rest of the baboons. So I think speciesistic talk, and as a field worker, it's individual variations that really drive our research. I mean, it's just amazing to watch coyotes or wolves over and over again and see amazing individual differences. The role of science. I'm going to skip through some of these just because you've heard about it. Science is one way of access. Yes?
Can you give a specific example of a specially compelling example of individual variation?
I'm going to get into this, and I will at the end. I want to keep rolling. My brain is on go. Is that okay? Anthropomorphism. I like to dispense with it really, really rapidly because I think, once again, it's kind of a hook on which a lot of people hang their jackets when they don't want to really face the reality of who we are studying other animals. So what happens with me, it's kind of a double-edged sword, I think. For example, when I say an elephant isn't happy in captivity, my critics will say, oh, you're just being anthropomorphic. You know, she's happy, and then it gets really quiet. And what they're realizing is, of course, attributing positive emotions and negative emotions, still you're committing, if you say it's a sin, some people think, you know, being anthropomorphic. But if you really take an evolutionary point of view of behavior and you think of it in terms of Darwin's ideas about evolutionary continuity, then we're not inserting something into animals that they don't have. Okay? The bumper sticker, and I'm going to get back to this, in terms of evolutionary continuity, is if we have something, they have it too. Okay? There's always been this resistance about applying continuity because we apply it all the time in anatomy, physiology, biomedical research. But when it comes to behavior, people have been more resistant. So this isn't to say that dog joy is the same as human joy. My joy may not be the same as your joy, but it doesn't mean you have it and I don't, or vice versa. Okay, so I think we just really need to accept the fact that it's bad biology to deny certain capacities to non-human animals. Oops. Okay, so the questions that I'm interested in dealing with the evolution of social behavior, if you will, the evolution of emotions, I try to follow a scheme that was put forth by Nico Tinbergen, who won the Nobel Prize along with Conrad Lorenz and Carl von Frisch back in 1973 in physiology and medicine. And of course, a lot of hardcore biomedical researchers were really upset that somebody who, you know, chased foxes around or studied homing in wasps or bee language in the case of von Frisch would win the Nobel Prize. Tinbergen put forth a nice little scheme where he said there's four areas that we want to concentrate on when we study behavior. How did it evolve? You know, what forces would select for the appearance, if you will, and retention of a behavior? in an animal's repertoire? How did it allow an animal to adapt to his or her environment? What causes the behavior? And he's one of the first that really called attention in the ethology literature to the importance of external stimuli and internal stimuli, hormones, neural circuits, things like that, and ontogeny, not ontology. My students always like to talk about Tinbergen and ontology. And the last was added by Gordon Burghardt, who's a really well-known comparative psychologist, talking about private experience. You know, the question is, like we've heard, you know, why would the ability to, quote, recognize yourself or some level of self-awareness evolve? You know, what's it good for? Okay. So this is a very useful scheme for tying together the way in which a lot of people in my field go about trying to answer different questions. This is, Dale Jameson gave me this slide. This is one of our dogs reading Darwin. And I always wonder what Darwin would say about what we're learning about our animal minds. The important point to take away here is that Darwin was just arguing that the differences among species are differences in degree rather than differences in kind. Shades of gray, not black and white differences. So how like us are they? All mammals share the same structures in the limbic system that are important in feeling, important for feeling, important for emotional lives. I just saw this article this week that the amygdala volume correlates with the size and complexity of social networks in humans. We don't know about this in non-humans, but there are people who are interested in this. So there is continuity, and once again, a lot of times I think the answer to the question of how similar are we to them or vice versa depends on who you are and what you're studying. We can make the divisions as large as we want or as small as we want. We also have to remember that animals communicate using different modalities. So you can read this. When you give night talks, this wakes people up. But I mean, really, if I were a dog, my dream would be to pee on everything I could. Okay? And dogs are rather discriminating. So, and I was telling some people before, but this whole discussion on mirror recognition. Years ago, a guy named Michael Fox and I tried to do the mirror test with the dot on the head on wolves, and they failed it, right? And we sent the paper in because we thought the negative data were important, and a certain man read it and just bashed us as if we had an IQ of 3, which may be the case, but it definitely had nothing to do with the paper we sent in. And so what I did years later was every morning when I would walk my dog below my house, I live in the mountains outside of Boulder, when there was snow on the ground, I would move yellow snow from one place to another, his and other dogs, so that they couldn't see me moving the snow, blah, 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 blah. And over 5 years, I could collect enough data to see how they responded to their own and other urine. Needless to say, the local paper warned people that I wasn't some psycho, but I had like surgical gloves because I didn't want to contaminate the urine. I had to make sure that Jethro was somewhere else, you know, sniffing and wouldn't see me moving the snow. And what we found, and I can go into details later if you're interested, was Jethro responded to his own snow differently than he did the urine-packed snow of other animals. The fact that dogs and other animals don't pass the mirror mark test, it was silly for us to try, but it was around the time that Gallup published his early data, so we figured we would try to do it. Okay. So the point is, and you've heard it over and over again, we need to pay attention to the sensory and the motor worlds of other animals. We just can't ask them to do something that they can't do or haven't evolved to do and then conclude that because they don't do something, they can't do it. That's just something that is, it's a bad conflation in the behavioral literature. I had this in just, but you've already heard, you know, sort of the transition I like to think about is, you know, down from observing and describing behavior to different experiments, just leading us all through sort of in a reductionist schema to the neurobases of beliefs, if you will, and the molecular biology of beliefs, okay? But I'll tell you that in terms of animal behavior, it all starts with careful and detailed observations of animals. There's no substitute for that. So some people go out and they watch an animal for 100 hours and they think they know everything. We studied coyotes for 9 years in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. We had 5,000 or more hours of observation of known individuals. And the last day we were still discovering things. There's your example, one thing about the coyote. Coyotes living on one side of the Blacktail Butte, which is right outside of Moose, Wyoming, which is the headquarters for the Grand Teton National Park. There were coyotes living a kilometer apart. Over 9 years, there were packs on one side of the butte and individuals on the other. So talking about the coyote would be misleading even within a distance of a kilometer. And their social behavior really was different as well. So they would just be one example. So I'd done some bird work around my house. I tried to get funding for it. I got minimal funding, and then I had to make the really easy decision. Do I do the work and use $1,000 from my own pocket, or do I go back and forth to NSF when they weren't going to fund it anyway? I decided I'd rather collect data than sit and write grant proposals that had an 8% chance of being funded. So I'm just going to run you through one study, then another, and then draw some conclusions about why the cognitive and emotional capacities of animals really matter. So the question that we were interested in was, in the scientific literature of cross species, people have detected a relationship between group size and individual vigilance or anti-predatory behavior. On average, the larger the group, the less an individual has to scan for predators. And they trade off, like in some birds, you can't scan and feed at the same time. Jerry Ford couldn't chew gum and walk at the same time, so you understand what I'm saying. Neither could George Bush. But what was interesting to me was we were studying this in Western Evening Grosbeaks. This is outside my house, by giving them food and just looking at patterns of feeding and scanning in different size groups. And one day I was playing frisbee with my dog Jethro, and the frisbee went up on my roof, and I walked up on my roof and I looked down and I realized, my goodness, you know, these birds align themselves in circles and along the railing where they can only see their nearest neighbor. Okay, and this led to like a 12-year study, just that observation. Now, it seems really obvious to people, but it wasn't obvious. And the fact of the matter is, no one before we had done this study had looked at the effect of geometry and group size on the scanning and feeding patterns of birds. In fact, they hadn't looked at it really in any other animal. Nico Tinbergen had some data that he collected years ago on red foxes on a beach in England. So basically, you're interested in questions like, what is a group? Is a group, I mean, this is something that I can't answer right now, but I will, because when we were studying coyotes, like, what's a group of animals? Are we a group? Are we a group? How long do two animals or four have to be together to call it a group? Is it just an aggregation? We happen to come together and then we part? Or are we a long-lived, enduring social group? So what's a group? How does group size and geometry, how do they interact? So what we basically did was I would feed the animals and force them either into a circular array or a linear array. In the circular array, they see all other group members. In a linear one, you only see the animal next to you. So if you're at the end, you see one animal. If you're in the middle, you might see an animal on either side of you. And then we just film them. I mean, when I was talking about the details, this is painstaking research, and went through a lot of work study students. But I'm serious about it. Just film about 20 minutes of this, and it could take a week or more to analyze the film. But you need to pay attention to the details. Okay, what are the animals doing? Those are the subjects, Western Evening Grosbeaks. We also banded about 2,000 of them, so we had some data on individual variation. This would be where we were filming from. So that would be the railing at my house, and birds would be in a line and a circle here. That would be sort of the view from the roof, if you will. So you could see, we could see the array. Those would be animals in a circle. And what we found, and you can memorize the data here. I actually never presented it, but at a meeting I was at about 3 years ago, somebody I don't know who he was, it doesn't really matter. He wondered whether we had data, and we really had data. We weren't making it up. Basically what we found were birds in a line spend more time being vigilant and show more head and body changes than birds in the circle. Okay? Birds in a line show less coordination and vigilance. They don't see one another. They're just basically looking around. And birds in a line show delayed responses to changes in group size. You couldn't really detect what was happening because you could only see one or two birds around you. So the bottom line is individuals change their behavior depending on the array in which they find themselves. Just this discussion this morning, are they subitizing or what are they doing? I mean, I'm just amazed at how fast animals can assess relative group size and do something about it. I'm not saying they're counting. I don't think they are, but it doesn't really matter. Their behavior really radically changes as a function of the number of other individuals who are around and the geometric array. So they're making some assessments of group size, okay, and they're getting some visual information. So anyway, that's one study. I'm just showing you as an example of things that we really, really need to do. It's just really complex out there, even for bird brains, if you will. Animal emotion is something that I study, and you know, people just get really upset. They say, oh, it's not tractable, you really can't study it. Or some people, of course, usually people who abuse animals, say, well, animals don't have emotions, they don't feel pain. Fine, I feel sorry for them. So picking out the notion of love, you know, how can we study it? Can we define it and actually collect data on animal emotions? I'm just going to use this. Yeah, we can. We can think of a definition of love or a long-term enduring bond where animals prefer, they show preferences for one another, they travel with one another, they defend food and territory together, they miss one another when they're separated, they seek one another out when they're apart, they raise young together, they defend food and territory together, they defend dens together, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So we can actually, I think the word is operationalize. I hate to use that in a group of philosophers, but I'm not a philosopher, so you can't grade me. So the important point is that we can define other emotions using behavior and objective criteria. And we don't have to say, you know, that dogs are, quote, happy. I love when people say, well, yeah, dogs are, quote, happy. Or mice, quote, feel quote, pain. I mean, they're either happy or they're not happy, okay? The quotes are dismissive because people feel uneasy using certain words to assign emotions. Just some slides. Like, this is a mated pair of foxes. Do they love one another? We can ask this question and we can do the science behind it. It's a mated pair who, they mated for 5 years, they raised babies together and they played with one another and they defended territories. And they preferred one another. When one was lost once, this is not far from the house, they sought one another out. Same criteria, you know, we would use for humans, and we're hardly the species who has the hold on love. What is this, a happy dog? Okay? I mean, we can ask that question. You know, we could ask the question of what is this dog thinking? You know, does this dog have any kind of envy or jealousy? And some of you may know about recent research in a phenomenon called equity aversion, where you can have two animals. One of the last studies was done on dogs, where you train a dog to shake, some of them done on monkeys, and you have them next to one another, and you give them a bone, and they shake, because dogs would do anything for food. Then you give a more salient reward to one dog, and the other dog stops shaking. Okay? So people go, oh my goodness gracious, you know, that kind of research, that's just really, you know, it's unimportant, it's all anthropomorphic. And it happened to be published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, okay? The important point is that a lot of this research that people kind of wrote off years ago is being published in journals such as Science, Nature, and the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, okay? I think that's important to mention so that when people go, oh, you're just a dog lover, you know, you see these things in the animals, but they don't really have these abilities or capacities, they're wrong, unless the reviewers are wrong. Is this a happy dog? I just like that one. Do animals have a sense of awe and wonder? This is a picture Jane Goodall took of male chimpanzees often do what's called this waterfall dance. And once again, it's a fair question. There's a lot of people interested in the evolution of religion and spirituality. Are there roots in non-human animals? I was with Jane in northern Spain, in Girona. We went to a chimpanzee sanctuary, and we had been told about a chimpanzee there named Marco, who when it rained and thundered would go into a trance. I'd never seen this. Of course, Jane had seen it many times. It's riveting to see this behavior. So it's a fair question, and it's tractable. What's going on in Marco's brain? Okay? It's not fluff. An angry baboon who I met in the Masai Mara. What are these elephants doing and feeling? There are elephants up in Samburu, where Ian Douglas Hamilton studies. And Eleanor and Gracie were friends, and one died, and they do grieving ceremonies. You just have to see it. What's going on here with a baby elephant who ultimately died? I mean, there's something going on in these brains. There's feelings going on in the brains. In a sense, it's almost too bad that somebody didn't go in and either collect dung or blood to see whether there are any serological changes. I had the joy of going out and collecting elephant dung among 50 wild elephants in Samburu, because you can collect the dung, they freeze it, they send it to a genetics lab in Denmark, at the time they were doing it there, and you can get information on diet, kinship relationships, levels of stress, reproductive status. A good non-invasive way, because elephants don't like being mucked with. And when you're sitting in a Land Rover surrounded by 50 large elephants, you don't want to be the mucker. Or the mucky. Just some slides. I think one of the major points I'm going to make is I think we can get a lot out of behavior. About 5 years ago, I was riding my bicycle back into Boulder with a friend of mine who knew nothing about animal behavior. We came across a dead magpie in the road. There were 5 magpies surrounding them. One walked in, pecked the corpse, another did the same. They stayed in a circle. One flew off, brought back some twigs and pine needles, dropped them by the carcass. Another did. They stayed around the carcass and then almost imperceptibly bowed their heads. And like I was mesmerized, and my friend Rod said, "Oh, you see this all the time." And I'm going, no, I've never seen this. So I published it, and to date I probably got 70 stories that have come in from around the world, typically magpies, corvids, magpies, crows, and ravens, and I just had one from about sparrows in England. And I wish Dale were here, because when Dale and I work together, we don't know where it came from, but one of our favorite sayings is the plural of anecdote is data. And so, does this happen? Well, yeah, I mean, I think it happens. I mean, I've got a lot of stories of people seeing very similar things. So once again, because the study of, you know, sort of animal minds, maybe animal emotions, is in its infancy, there's a lot of work to do, and we shouldn't be drawing any sorts of conclusions in some ways. But do birds grieve? Well, I think what I saw there was a grieving ceremony. I don't care what you call it. I mean, it was really amazing to watch them bow their heads and then just all fly away after dropping some pine needles by the dead animal. Another question I've been really interested in is the evolution of moral behavior. Can animals be moral beings? Is there a moral gap? I mean, once again, I find it amazing that we human beings think that we set the standard for moral behavior when we invade countries and destroy nations and do all the horrible things we do. But I guess that's our privilege. But this is something I've been working on for a really long time with respect to animal play behavior. Jessica Pearson and I published this in a book called Wild Justice. And if you really want to know about it, read my kids' book. I'm embarrassed to say that we've caught 30 years of research in 28 pages and 400 words for kids. But I mean, seriously, it's all there. So basically, when we study play, I'm just going to run through a few slides. We don't need this. I'll come back to that. So when we study play, the way we do our studies, once again, we film the animals and we play it back frame by frame. Okay? so that we can see what the animals are doing. Just some, you know, stills. Two dogs playing at the Vatican. I just had to. When animals play, they do incredible gymnastics. And you can see that, you know, this is like on a motor drive camera. There's a lot going on in those four pictures that you're not going to catch with the human eye. So these are just some stills from video. You can see one of the dogs growling here. And the important thing is when animals are playing, they're using behavior patterns from different other contexts. So they'll be biting one another, slamming into one another, mounting one another. So it could look like it's aggression, it could look like predation, it could look like mating behavior. So somehow they have to tell one another this is play, not aggression, not mating, not you know, fighting. Yeah, baby wolves. These are young coyotes playing. If you've never seen baby coyotes in the field, it's worth it. That's trust. So one of the things I'm just going to run you through in quicker than 28 pages. We were interested in how animals communicate their intention to play. I want to play with you. I don't want to fight with you. I don't want to mate with you. I don't want to dominate you. So we looked at an action called the play bow. You've all seen it where a dog bows, puts his butt up in the air, wags his tail, sometimes barks. You see across species like these lions up here. So a whole lot of different behavior patterns have evolved signal function to say this is play, not aggression, or fighting, or mating. So that's the play bow. And what we did, and we did this a long time ago, but we've repeated it, is we played back frame by frame of dogs, coyotes, baby wolves, and baby dogs playing. We timed it. So how long the play bow lasted and how far the shoulders were lowered from, say, a horizontal. Question was, how stereotyped, how ritualized is the play bow? We controlled for body size because if you didn't, then if a dachshund lowered its shoulder to the same size as a Great Dane, it would be 6 feet underground. Okay. So basically, we measured them. This took years to do the film analysis, but we never would have detected this without doing the analyses. Bows are very stereotyped and easy to recognize. Bows performed at the beginning of a sequence are less variable, more stereotyped than bows during a sequence. There could be a lot of reasons. One might be we're already playing, I bite you too hard, and I'll just do a quick bow to say we're still playing. So that led into a long-term research. We actually had to go back, not only get new film, but look at old film, to look at the placement of play bows. And what we found across young domestic dogs, young coyotes, and young wolves, is that they use play bows with some kind of intention in mind to say, this is still play, even if I'm going to bite you hard. Or the bows immediately follow a hard bite, where they might be saying, I'm sorry I bit you so hard, it's still play. The statistics bear out the fact that they don't use play bows randomly. So something's going on there, okay? I think what it's going on is they learn that they have a certain sense of right and wrong and what is accepted. And what we learned in the field, we have these data, we didn't intend to collect them. No one else has ever been able to collect these. It's just luck. What we found was that young coyotes who violate the rules of social play tend to be expelled from or leave their pack, go off on their own, and suffer 4 times higher mortality. So is there something between fitness and fairness? I don't know. But I'm just saying that those are the sorts of data that we need. And we just collected them. I mean, when we collected these data, we didn't have any idea that they might have some significance. The point is, though, that if you look at social animals, they've got to negotiate their social relationships. They need to know in a group what other animals may be thinking, what they're feeling, what they're likely to do. They don't reinvent the world every single day. And if you spend enough time watching these animals, you'll see that they're very good at predicting the behavior of other animals in certain social situations and then modifying their behavior according to what they are maybe predicting what other animals might do. Okay, so I think it's really important. I mean, I think what Dale sets up something then a little too impossible to collect these data, but I really do think that if we go out and spend the time in the field watching these animals, then we will learn a lot about them. And people wonder, oh, well, it's under control, it's over controlled. Well, I don't know, but nobody's going to convince me that just because you have four animals in a cage and observe everything they do and do the controlled studies that you're really getting who these animals are and what their capacities are. Okay, so I think it's a trade-off of where we can, what would be the best location to answer the questions at hand. I also published an article in Ranger Rick. Because really, this is the best way to summarize the research. Well, you play, you ask first, you're honest, you mind your manners, and you admit when you're wrong. And one thing people will always say is, oh no, play always escalates into aggression. No, you're wrong. No, the fact is we studied this. We've gone to dog parks. I did this in the field. It's 2% or something of the time it escalates. So once again, it catches your attention when it escalates, but it's actually a very rare occurrence. So something's going on there, and I'm just trying to continue to figure it out. An interesting question people ask is, are the more social species, do they show more subtle or nuanced moods, emotions, senses of fairness? I don't know, but if you look at the number of facial expressions among canids, wolves, foxes, dogs, and coyotes, you find that the more social animals have more and different facial expressions. So we call this the facial ecology of emotions or something like that. And we also know from some early work that wolves have amazing number of tail positions, more so than the less social. So once again, if I were a grad student, there's a zillion theses waiting to be done out there. So, why do animal feelings matter? What can we do? I know. I actually got this at an airport in Salt Lake City. Does it surprise you? No, I shouldn't say that. Having spent a lot of time in Utah, it didn't surprise me one bit. One of the major things is that animals are considered to be property under the law. We can really do anything that we want to animals. And in the United States, 99% of all animals used in research are not protected by the Federal Animal Welfare Act. We now know that mice show empathy. Once again, not some garage study done at McGill University by respected neuroscientists published in the journal Science that mice show empathy. That has not factored in one bit to the way mice are treated in research 6 years after. It's not even been added to the Federal Animal Welfare Act. In last December 2009, the European Union ratified the Treaty of Lisbon, which grants legal status to animals by virtue of sentience. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Sometimes people say, oh, you're just making up data that there is not that much laboratory abuse. Yeah, these are easily accessible data. You can read these, 2,100 violations reported. Okay, these are not violations that have occurred when people didn't know what was happening. I always say good welfare isn't good enough. You can answer these questions for yourself. Is starving rats and blinding cats and injecting diseases into chimpanzees good welfare? Is it permissible? Okay, people will vary on these answers. According to the FDA, 92 of every 100 drug tests that pass animal trials do not pass human trials. Not only is it a waste of animals' lives, it's a waste of a lot of time and a lot of money. So I'm just going to run through. One of the things is, even if you don't care about animal welfare or ethics, scientists are becoming increasingly concerned that the data they're collecting is from stressed animals. It's a woman named Ann Baldwin at Arizona State has published extensively on this. Just the environment in which, like, laboratory mice or rats are kept different noise levels, different odors, different sounds can be stressful. So one failure to replicate certain studies might simply be because the animals are not in the, quote, same situation. If you take drugs that are tested on animals, if you do LD50 tests, the results differ than when you keep rabbits alone or in a group, because rabbits are social animals. So I'm just throwing this out that there's lots of reasons to care about the way animals are treated other than having a concern as being some animal rights nut or something like that. I think the guiding principle is first do no harm. They have a point of view. These are two dogs pulling apart Michael Vick's jersey. But these are general questions that I think we need to ask. What are these horses feeling? What are these wild animals feeling, especially like these animals who were chased for hours by a helicopter and shot in Idaho by the Division of Wildlife? What's happening with polar bears? Polar bears are following traditional swimming routes, and they're discovering that the ice isn't there. And polar bear mommies and their babies are washing up on the shores of water in Alaska and in the north. My friend has been studying that. Who we eat is a moral act. Who we wear is a moral act. If there's a sentient animal on the plate, it's not what's for dinner, it's who's for dinner. And once again, I think that these kinds of conclusions stem from the research that we're doing. I don't know how to advance. This is where it got stuck. Oh, yeah. My favorite pig. I want to get to the end and draw some conclusions. And I didn't want to. Let me just keep going. Just different, I travel a lot, you know, just different ways people treat animals around the world. This is all okay to do. I'll end with just a study, a quick 2 minutes. I do a lot of work in China, where we rehabilitate moon bears who have been used in the bear bile industry. This is the group Animals Asia. Haley here is about 5'6". This is a cage in which Fonzie was kept for 15 years. She didn't grow. And this is me feeding her. She's actually this tall. She just died this year. Her growth was stunted. That's me feeding a bear named Jasper. You have to add another minute because of the, no. This is where Jasper lived for 15 years, in a cage on his side with a catheter in his gallbladder, only able to move his head and his neck for bile in traditional Chinese medicine. I'm an optimistic person, although I do a lot of work in really weird and depressing places. This is Jasper now. Okay, I mean, I need to end on a positive note, but this is Jasper now after a couple of years of rehab. He didn't move for 15 years, so somehow he's able to move now. He didn't lose all his motor abilities. I'm sure he has flashbacks. I'm sure he's got severe trauma lurking in his brain, but, and this is his friend Bowie getting a pedicure. I have to show you this because these are animals. We just rescued an animal about 9 months ago who spent 30 years in a cage no bigger than this. And he seems to be coming out of it. So, come on. So, I think one place that we go is to the kids. And this is just a book that just came out last week. You know, what can we do? You know, and what we did was we did events all over the world. We asked kids what they thought about animals, what their dreams were, what they were thankful for. I'm just showing you this because I believe that as we learn more and more about animals, we should be definitely training kids to be ambassadors for the future. I don't know what. So. Conclusions. We need to use the right method for the questions at hand, at our hand. What are called ecologically relevant methods, and I talked about yellow snow experiments. Negative results don't mean an individual doesn't have the smarts to do something. I know you can read all this. We shouldn't be talking about the chimpanzee or the coyote. There's been a great deal of selection for behavioral flexibility. I want to say especially in social animals, but I don't really know that that's the case. Individuals need to be able to express their full behavioral repertoire. I harp on that all the time because I watch people do studies of dogs in cages and coyotes in cages, and they're seeing things that I never saw in the field. So it may be that the animals have the capacity to do certain things, but they don't typically express them when they're able to be the normal animals. Cognitive explanations can be parsimonious, and I think the killjoy explanations ignore this. And animals are not necessarily acting as if they know something. Dan Dennett, who some many of you know, was at this meeting in UCLA last week, and he talked about what he called the sorta phenomenon. And he and I really got into it because I agree with a lot, but I disagree with a lot. So it's like animals sorta act like this, or they sorta feel this, or they sorta do this. And where do you draw the line? Okay. But I think that continuity, if you ascribe to evolutionary continuity, you could draw that conclusion without demeaning the animals. And then my last conclusion is that it's wrong to cause intentional harm to sentient and other beings. And I will end with Jasper. So anyway, thank you for listening to me.